Dave Max Cork History Matters, brought to you by Red FM.
Jim O'Neill, thank you for joining me for this Cork History Matters podcast chat. It's one I've been looking forward to for a long time. I'm from Dundalk. I've lived in Cork since the 90s. The Battle of Kinsale has always fascinated me. There's a wider, longer story to it. It involves Hugh O'Neill, who it turns out has Dundalk connections, which added an extra layer of interest for me to it. And it almost feels like it was a time when potentially Gaelic Ireland, or at least Gaelic Ireland at that time, had been much influenced by the Norman and subsequent English conquest. And of course, you know, Henry VIII had led the Reformation through the 1500s. And so Ireland was a much changed place, but it felt like it was the last gasp chance for Gaelic Ireland to assert some kind of sense of sovereignty in its own territory, on its own island. And it lost that chance at Kinsale. Hugh O'Neill, the primary figure of it, submits to Mountjoy in Mellifont Abbey in County Louth, and in 1605 or 07, he and O'Donnell set sail from Rathmullen. I mean, it's hugely dramatic. Ulster's been laid waste. You know, the Ulster had been the most Gaelic part of Ireland, the fastness that had held out against encroachment, and now it's the one that's planted and is the successful plantation, and all of that follows after that. Like, it just feels fundamental to the whole story of Irish history. You wrote the book that thankfully was able to, you know, allow me to delve through that in a wider way. And are you a Belfast man, Jim?
Oh, very much so, yeah.
But UCC was either what enabled you to write this book, or you were certain. What's your connection to UCC?
Well, thanks for having me on, Dave. The crack is with that is I did the research for the book, PhD. Up in Queens, in Belfast. I've been a Queens guy through undergrad and masters and PhD. It's all been Queens. But the thing that brings me down to UCC is Dr. Harry Morgan. He's the guy. He's the guy that wrote Tyrone's Rebellion. And so he got me in there as part of the Irish Research Council, a two-year fellowship. And part of that was to turn the PhD into the book, which when you finish PhDs, you think, hey, look, that's it. That's all the work needs to be done. And then you realize there's a ton more needs to turn a PhD into something that anyone actually wants to read.
Well, just to establish the Cork, I mean, there's lots of Cork in the story that we're going to delve through anyway, and Munster, obviously. But so did you come down to Cork for the couple of years? Had you known it before? Where did you live? How did you get on?
I came down and I stayed down just outside Cork. And sort of split my time between there and Belfast, because that's the whole thing about academia, like how people actually shift their entire lives from one place to the other. They're better people than me. But yeah, I split my time between Cork and Belfast.
Did you walk the parts of it that you knew were, you know, within? Obviously you did. I mean, Inishannon, I think, is where O'Neill was based. And then, you know, like you're quite clear in your descriptions around Kinsale as to where all the action took place. So did you spend many afternoons taking sorties around where the action happened?
More than you could imagine, to tell you the truth.
Well, hang on. What? Like, I love the opening to the book, which is the 9 Years' War, which is in itself questionable as to whether it was 9, 10, 14.
Yeah, 10 Years' War, yeah.
But I love this opening. It's no understatement to say this book has long been in the coming. It's occasionally pointed out by a friend or family member that I've been researching this conflict for longer than it lasted. And surely I must be done with it now. What was your fascination of it? I mean, I think you do lay out in that opening what your fascination is, but where did it put a hook in you?
To tell you the truth, it actually happened. I'd been working in Belfast with it's called the Environment Heritage Service, just like the archaeology people up there. And I'd been doing a battlefield database trying to put together where the archaeology battlefields would be in Northern Ireland. And so we decided we were going to try and get a metal detecting program put together just to proof, you know, to test what sort of archaeology there was. And one of the battlefields that most needed it done was the Battle of Yellow Ford. So we went, right, we'll go for the Battle of Yellow Ford. And we did the work there, and we found archaeological features and all the rest of that, and archaeological, you know, musket shot and things like that. And that sort of really, it sort of reawakened my interest in the 9 Years' War, because years and years before that, when I was doing like third year history, and I remember we're getting taught the 9 Years' War and third year's history. And the way it was taught was there was this guy, Tyrone, and he started this big war against the English to put them out. And it goes, win, 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 win. they win the yellow forward, and then it's like someone flicks a switch and they go lose, and they get hammered at Kinsale, and it was all like, well, that seemed all a bit easy, and the story just didn't really sit right with me. And so after this work at yellow forward, I decided to keep looking at it, and I'd been doing a part-time degree for years in Queens. And so I started to focus on things about the 9 Years' War, elements of it. And first, then after Yellow Ford, I started to look at the battles in the Moray Pass in 1600. So I did that for undergrad. And then for masters, I went, I'm not bad, but this seemed to be working out. So I kept doing it and did more work in the 9 Years' War, more work in the 9 Years' War. And by the end of the masters, like, right, PhD time, let's see what we can do here. And so looked at the 9 Years' War, specifically using the military evidence, because a lot of, like, there's a lot of people do social histories and economic history and all the rest of that. And they tell you, for sometimes in history, military history is a bit of a dirty word. No, you get sort of weird looks of like, yeah, he does military history. He must like dressing up at the weekends and things like that.
And even if you did, happy
if
days.
If that's what floats your boat, fill your boots. It's not my bag, but a lot of very good people at this do that and knock yourself out. But no, you get suspicious looks. They're like, yeah, military history is all about he must love war, which, to tell you the truth, if you study military history deeply enough, you'll get a profound hatred for the whole concept of it. It's a terrible thing to study, but it does actually show very much in relief the human condition, you know, the worst and the best of humans.
Well, and also the technological changes taking place through that period that can influence the outcomes of so many aspects that then influence the history and what, you know, because I think in this book you talk about how Europe itself was going through a revolution in warfare through that period, and that the Irish, this 9 Years' War fed into that, and that there was a sort of an underappreciation for the technical nous and ability of O'Neill and the armies he managed to gather around him and their abilities in the battlefield. Whereas, you know, historically, it's seen that Irish fighters weren't up to much when they were taking on the English. Whereas in this case, actually, they were.
Oh, when you're doing the research, actually, believe it or not, it was like an open goal. There was so little done on it that you had people like Cyril Falls who'd written Elizabeth's Irish Wars back in the 50s, and everyone thought, well, that's that done. And he was very much really sort of like, well, the Irish sort of copied the English, and he did quite well for a while. And then, of course, the English just sort of rolled back Tyrone's achievements, and that was that, because sure, wasn't it always going to be that way? And I wasn't buying into that at all. So what we did, what I did was look at it, and there was this whole, it's a big, still a debate ongoing about, was it a revolution? Was it evolution of military techniques and the gunpowder revolution in Europe? But Ireland was always seen as some sort of peripheral thing, and not really that much happened. If you look at broader texts, it's almost like it wasn't happening in Ireland. But once you started looking at it in detail and taking apart, you end up doing it with maybe spend too much time working in archaeology. You just start to dissect what's taken for granted and see how these decisions have came to. And all of a sudden you're realizing that a lot of what Falls had written was basically founded on a misconception of what the Irish were doing. And what it turned out is that, like, he would have said that the Irish copied the English because, of course, the English troops were here and they just copied what they were doing and the weapons they were using. But later, as the work went on, what it was shown is that not only were the Irish more technically competent with the weapons, the gunpowder weapons, they were actually, and rather than just copying them, because that was done before, certainly in Connacht after the Spanish Armada in 1588, some of the O'Flaherty, they just copied the Spanish and took on Spanish guns, had Spanish captains, and copied exactly what the Spanish were doing. And of course, the English turned up, hammered them, because the English have been fighting troops like that in the continent and the Low Countries and winning. So they had no problem with dealing with modern methods of warfare. What Tyrone did, he said, well, that's not going to work because the English are used to fighting that way. So what Tyrone does is he takes the best of the technological advances, the firearms and the drill and all the rest of that, and couples it with what's good about Irish warfare: the speed, the flexibility, the competency. People always, whenever they look at Irish warfare, they say, "Oh, there's an awful lot of skirmishing and running away and things like that." If you look at the contemporary texts in 16th, 17th century warfare, all of them recount how skirmish warfare is actually technically far more difficult, and you need far better troops and far more reliable troops to fight and win skirmishes than stand-up battles. And one of the terms, like the Duke of Alba, a Spanish officer, said that basically you can win a battle with just ordinary line troops, but you need elite troops to win skirmishes. So the amount of training that went into this, and so what he created was this hybrid force that was almost entirely dependent on firepower, which is a complete reversal of what had been seen before. That's, anyone's familiar with Irish warfare at this time, they'd always know about the Galaglass, know about the big Galaglass axes and the heavy mail, and the cairn with their spears and very light, irregular type warfare. Totally transforms that, takes this whole hand-to-hand, melee-orientated warfare, turns it on its head, converts his Galaglass and cairn into pike and shot, but doesn't copy, doesn't just ape the English, doesn't have like these compact formations of densely packed pikemen surrounded by shot, armed with musketeers. What he does is he creates this loose formations of shot. All their combat power is predicated on firepower, on shooting people, but not in big, deep lines. What they had is they would literally skirmish an enemy to death. They had these loose formations that were flexible.
Almost hybrid guerrilla warfare.
Don't
even get you started.
Don't say the G word.
Is that because it'll set you off, or because it really bothers you that it's an absolute misconception?
Oh, it's a misconception. It was called, even at the time, they called it mixed warfare.
Let me hold you, because I don't think that's the key thing. I just think we're a few minutes into this and there's terms popping up that like I'm certainly somewhat familiar with, but I want to take us back. And I think as we go through it is maybe we'll highlight who are the key people and where they've come from. But where I'd maybe like to start you off, and it's a way back, so feel free to move through it quickly, I suppose somewhere in the 1500s, Henry VIII comes to power and the Reformation occurs. Anne Boleyn and the Catherine of Aragon and all of this sort of thing, the dissolution of the churches. So all of a sudden you've introduced a whole new concept into the Irish-English relationship, and it's a religious one. I mean, it's not that that's the overarching thing, but it fundamentally changes the nature of it. We have the old Irish, the Anglo-Normans, or the you could almost call them the Norman French that came to or the Cambrian Norman, I've heard them described, because they were Normans. Well, I mean, here's the thing that if anyone is unaware, that might blow their mind. The Normans were Vikings who were attacking so deep into France, they were granted the territory in the north of France. 100 years later, they beat the English. Like, it's never really flagged much that the English were taken over by the Norman. I mean, it is, but they don't really seem to see that as, a badge of not humiliation necessarily, but that like the English were defeated and taken over by the Normans in 1066. And it's 100 years odd later that those Normans, loosely based in Wales, the various knights, come to Ireland, and that's who they are, speaking largely French at the time. But by this period in the 1500s, it's the English. And there's the Reformation, the dissolution of the churches. There's an attempt to reconquer Ireland. True or not, the old Irish had become more Irish than the Irish themselves, but certainly there was a huge mixing of the cultures, and the Norman Irish were no longer English. They weren't Gaelic Irish, but they were a mix of the two, and there was a loose interacting. I mean, was it a comfortable enough situation between the old Irish and the Gaelic Irish at that time?
Well, there was certain friction, to say the least. I think the term that has been accepted for them now is we call them the Old English.
That's probably what I meant to be saying there, actually.
Descendants from the old Anglo-Normans. And there was a difference, without doubt there's differences, and there was friction, but there was a huge amount of interaction. But the most important thing was they were still Catholic, whereas you have the Reformation in England and the Protestantization of England. the Old English here remain Catholic, and the Old English Lords remain Catholic. Mm-hmm. And that's a definite connection between the Gaelic Irish
and a bonding thing. My apologies. Old English is what I meant to be saying there. But where I wanted to go from actually the start point was the Spanish and the English in a European context are excuse me, and the English themselves are not the great state and great nation that we might know them. I mean, they were considered the pirates of the high seas by the Spanish Empire at that time, rich on gold from America, presumably, in the 1500s. Francis Bacon and all of these guys are harassing Spanish ships, and the English are. You know, it's under Elizabeth really that they come together and grow as a nation and as a European power, when I suppose they beat off the Spanish, and that's that 1588. The Spanish Armada set sail. They're chased up over around England and around Ireland, and the ships founder and all that goes on. But and around that time are the Desmond rebellions as well. And these are the Old English. I mean, that's who the Desmonds and the Earl of Ormond. Like, what does it mean to be an Earl if you're the Earl of Kildare, or if you're the Earl of Ormond, or the Earl of Desmond?
Well, of course, you have the status that goes along with it, and the power and the wealth and all the rest of that. But the England that you're talking about, I think, has benefited a lot by modern historiography that has created this great nation under Gloriana, under Elizabeth. That's not really the case. They were very much a second-rate nation by European standards. Spain was the heavy hitter. You also got to remember that the 1588, the Spanish Armada gets great press because of the Battle of Gravelines and the destruction of the Spanish fleet as they go up around Scotland and Ireland. What doesn't get great press is the English Armada the next year that got absolutely tanked as it tried to take Cadiz and move around and to move on Lisbon, that lost as many, if not more, than Spain did. And then you got to remember that even though Spain had the Spanish Armada in 1588, you have the English Armada which gets a battering in 1589. Spain sends another armada in 1596, and then another one in 1597. That's the kind of military power, that's the kind of wealth Spain has. And compared to that, England is really very secondary. The worst it can do is it can send supporting troops into the Low Countries to help
the uprising
in their war against Spain. And so they provide assistance there, and they provide assistance, but they're not a big military power.
But nonetheless, in comparison to Ireland, it's four or five times the population. As economically, they are a much bigger player than how Ireland is at that time.
Oh, economically, there's no comparison. That's actually why when you come to look at what Tyrone did, that it's not the people always say, well, he lost. Maybe that's a spoiler. Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself. But how he got so far.
Yes. And how he ends up then hunting with the new king. I mean, it's bizarre how it all, himself and Mountjoy chase each other, or Mountjoy chases him around the country, and they end up like, seemingly there's a story of them sharing a stable on the night together and drinking it up and having the crack ahead of him. I don't know whether it's submitting or something, and then they go over, it's bizarre how all that works out. But let me hold up. There's an effort by Henry VIII to bring Ireland back under control, including the Old English, the earls, who are living in their own fiefdoms and kingdoms and kind of going along as they want and paying lip service to presumably what they see as the central authority that they don't really have to abide hugely by, as long as they keep it kind of a bit tickety-boo. And there's even an uprising in Munster, the Desmond Rebellion, which maybe isn't necessary to focus in on, but it sort of influences the matter in terms of what happens then that little bit later. But the what I want to ask about is the submit and regrant. Is that what it's called? Mm-hmm. And
surrender and regrant.
So this is again the English crown trying to. So it's kind of going, you surrender to us, we'll give you a title, but you've come underneath the mantle. We sort of like we'll give you a certain level of freedom, but it's only on the understanding that you've agreed that we call the shots or we're the top dogs. And so there's a bunch of earls created around Ireland who are the Gaelic chieftains, for want of a better word, or the most powerful figures within a geographical area. And amongst them is Con O'Neill, who is the first Earl of Tyrone. Mm-hmm. Is this correct?
Yeah, absolutely. One of this brings their power, their privilege under English law as opposed to Irish.
Gotcha.
Not all of them go in there. Like, you do get Conn goes for it. Shane O'Neill does not.
Now, is Shane his legitimate son?
Shane is, what is the connection to that?
Because I'll tell you what I have, right? And again, we're probably thrown off, is, so there's Matthew is his illegitimate son. And I kind of remember this because I was just fascinated by the Dundalk connection of it. Alison Kelly is the wife, seemingly the wife of I don't know what he is from Dundalk.
She goes, an alleged blacksmith, yeah.
Yes. She goes to the court of Conn O'Neill and says, he's your son. And he takes him and says, and so then there's Shane, who's the legitimate son, and Matthew, the illegitimate son, and Hugh is of Matthew's line. Hmm. But Shane knocks Matthew out of it, and then the English, like, they take Hugh O'Neill into the pale and educate him, whatever, because they're kind of like, let's breed him up to be a safe O'Neill, sort of, like, he's our choice to be. I don't know, it's a bit hard to follow all of that. He's the Baron of Dungannon, then he gets made the second Earl of Tyrone.
Yeah, Shane whacks Matthew, then his Tánaiste, which later becomes the O'Neill, Turlough Lineach, he whacks Tyrone's older brother. So he's absolutely lost under dynastically speaking. He is a dead end. The English take him in as a ward and send him to the Pale that we brought up with the Hovendons. And this is a typical thing that they normally do, is they will, and they do it even during the war, is that they'll take a loser in dynastic succession under Irish law, and support them. And so they want after Shane's dead, Turlough is made the O'Neill. So they see Tyrone as their man, educated in their ways, and he would be a perfect counterbalance to this Turlough, the O'Neill.
Because there's two things. There's the Earl, which is the English title, and there's the O'Neill, which is the Gaelic title.
Absolutely. The O'Neill under Irish law has legitimacy, whereas, again, the English title. And Tyrone, as Baron of Dungannon, he's pushing to get his earldom, and he does in 1587, I think it, he gets, or 1585, he gets his title as the Earl of Tyrone. But what he's saying, it's all about privilege and power. It's never get the one of the things about this whole period is never get into some sort of romantic notion about that comes much later, of some sort of national sense of liberty or no. It's about securing privilege and power.
And it's also mixed. People are on all sorts of sides. I mean, even Hugh O'Neill himself goes throughout the north campaigning with the English forces on various things, seemingly takes some of the Spanish Armada, kills the soldiers, hangs them, saves the officers on command. So, like, initially he's within the fold, but perhaps he has ambitions. Do we have any sense of where that might have come from, or where he's developed this, or? Like, so he's basically, he's kind of like he's English speaking, but probably also Gaelic speaking. I mean, he's a mix of cultures, isn't he?
He's very, very much a foot in both camps. And it's both are working for him. But he's ambitious, to say the least. And the fact that he's made it this far from the position of being a destitute 9-year-old speaks to his ambition and skill. And plus, he's meant to be incredibly charismatic as well. But what he sees is the encroachment of new English coming over, new English. The English in the latter part of the 16th century very much established a new English authority. And these are Protestants coming over, Protestant officers, Protestant administrators under the Lord Deputies.
And this is the attempt to reclaim Ireland and the Munster plantation and the like, which fails.
That's the Desmond Rebellion. That fails. And then you see the institution of the Munster Plantation, where they're bringing in settlers. And this has worked before, because you have this isn't the first plantation at all. You have the Offaly and Leash.
And that's the thing most people will know about Ulster and the Ulster Plantation, but they're probably not aware is that, like, that one worked because of how devastated Ulster was after, you know, Ulster, the story that we're in the midst of. But there were other ones that didn't. I mean, with Queen's County and King's County, presumably, the Offaly and Leash. Yeah. And the Munster one, I mean, at Bandon, I think, Bandon Town, mm-hmm. Middleton, that they're all of the, well, maybe Middleton's a little bit later, actually, because I think when you go into it, it's a 1600 something or other. So that's a little after. But you know, people mightn't be as aware of the earlier plantations that didn't work entirely, but people that came at that time are still there and they're descendants.
Oh, it was doing, the Munster plantation was doing very well until it wasn't. You have to remember that the way this war always gets framed, it's like a war from Ulster, but it wasn't a war from Ulster. It was, yes, the leadership was there. You had Tyrone, who was basically the pinnacle of this confederation. But there was Tyrone, there was O'Donnell over in Tyrconnell, over in Donegal. You have the O'Rourkes and the McMahons. The O'Rourkes from Connacht, and then the McMahons, was at South Ulster. But you also have Faye McHugh O'Byrne, who's hip deep in the whole thing.
Wicklow.
That's Wicklow.
And McMahon's kind of modern. I mean, that's Oriel. Is Oriel gone, the kingdom of Oriel, at that point?
No, it's still there. There's still mention. You'll still see it in the papers.
And some of what influenced O'Neill was when he saw how Oriel got broken up and subdivided and the McMahon power broken. And he said, I don't, that's not going to happen to us.
That's exactly what happened. They see it where that the method for what they do is they break apart the lordships and put them into one of the smaller lordships. And you can see certainly you have his archenemy, Sir Henry Bagnall, in Newry, and he's pushing for the Queen to make him president, Lord President of Ulster, because that's exactly what they're going to do. They're going to break up Irish power. And Tyrone sees that. Now, when that's happening, it comes at a very bad... It's somewhat, almost like when forces come together, all the one thing in itself wouldn't have happened, made this war happen, but a load of different things will happen. This is sort of the breakup of the McMahon lordship, the treatment of the O'Rourkes. You have a very corrupt Lord Deputy, Fitzwilliam, who isn't above taking a bribe, but is also isn't above reneging on a bribe, sometimes doesn't say bribe, because the McMahons did bribe him, didn't help him. And you have the Bagnall, this archenemy from Newry, against Tyrone, who absolutely despised. Tyrone was doing everything in his power to eat away his lordship. But also you have the arrival of the Spanish. People always say the Spanish Armada was a failure. But without the Spanish Armada and the deposition of all the officers and the troops in Ireland, without the Spanish Armada, there's every likelihood that this war would never have happened. Because what happens is they get political contacts with Spain. And it's through that.
And there's a feedback to Spain to say, we've got an insight here. We've got people we can use who are within the footprint that can destabilize our enemy, the English.
Yeah, they say they create these links and use Irish bishops to create a two-way channel. And they start to get political validation. Tyrone would have had a much harder job going to the Irish lords and going, join me, we're going to do this, and we're going to throw the English out. And it's like, what, you and whose army? What he can do is he can say, I have the backing of Spanish, the most powerful nation on the planet, or as far as the West is concerned.
Yeah.
And with that, he could go and say, the Spaniards are backing us, they're going to send money, they're going to send arms, and instead they're going to send troops. And this makes it a much, much easier deal for Tyrone. Okay, he wasn't beside it. If he still got rejected, he'd still say, okay, come on, join me, this will be great. And they go, nah, you're fine, Hugh. And he goes, okay then, I wasn't asking, I'm telling you. And he would soft soap them first, but he wasn't behind just having you killed and going to the next person going, because he did that.
And let me just try to get a sense of, like, not even necessarily the man, but like Dungannon, which for anyone geographically is just a little bit southwest of Loch Ney, it's right in the middle of Ulster. Is that his seat? Is he in a castle? Is he in robes? Is he in silk stockings? Does he live well? Is it hard to know?
He would have been dressed much like any other Anglo-Irish or Old English lord. He would have been dressed in the style that's befitting of an Irish lord. It would be very English style dressed with Irish accoutrements, things like, you know, the fine mantles and things like that, you know, like shaggy cloak. Because like I say, he had to be in both camps. He couldn't be alien in his own country. But he had the castle up in Dungannon. But it wasn't just, it was like a large tower house familiar across Ireland. But he had additions to that. Often there's a famous illustration that shows you Dungannon broken down. It was drawn after, at the end of the war. And you see this ruin of a tower house and English flag on it. But people forget that early in the war, you have his large tower house. He was getting married to, maybe getting ahead of myself here, but he eloped with and married Henry Bagnall's sister.
That's right. That added a bit of intrigue to it, didn't it, for Bagnall?
Which is just another reason why Bagnall absolutely despised him. Mabel was only 20 and he was, what, 41? So, like I say, he was quite the charmer.
Yeah.
And it's almost like she goes to Dungannon and she's like, I'm not living in that. And so he actually builds her this great big hall.
Yeah.
And that's where they're living. And it's not described in massive detail, but we know it's a big, large masonry hall, and that's where they went for feasting and things like that. Because there's later accounts where he comes, says where they're all having a big meeting in the hall, and then he comes out, and then he goes for some secret talks in the castle, which is beside it. And so that's where he went and did his secret stuff.
And like, even countryside-wise, I mean, there aren't really towns. There's no roads as such. There's paths and passes, and, you know, because even in the story, as you know, Tyrone is being hunted through here, there, and everywhere, and you're like, God, how hard can it be to find him? But there was no way to get through places. I mean, it was a vastness. Albeit Ireland's a small place, it's still big enough, you know, and wooded and hard to get through areas. And local knowledge would have been paramount, presumably, in terms of what's the terrain ahead of us, what's the way to go, where's the passes. I mean, would the place have been mapped?
Yeah, it was local knowledge. Well, mappers tend to, certainly one of the best mappers in Ulster, a guy called Bartlett, ended up losing his head for having the temerity to go and try and map Donegal. Local knowledge was absolutely essential. And there was actually large forests like Glenconcane in the north of Loch Ney, where even when O'Neill was on the run, the Lord Deputy knew that they would only catch him by luck, because no opportunity. But there was also much greater development than people have any conception for. The land, often the land is presented as wild and untamed and cows and all the rest of that. But O'Neill actually had turned over a lot of his land to agriculture. A lot of the reason why there was scorched earth was an attack on his ability to raise revenue. And at one point it was reckoned he could raise £40,000 from his lands in 1 year. That's a massive amount just for him. And it was reckoned over half his land was turned over to arable agriculture crops. And even when reports were coming out of around Coleraine, O'Cahan's land in 1600, Docker was mentioning how this land was actually producing as much as any county shire in England of crops. Look, this is, and when Mountjoy was raiding in the Midlands, he said he's never seen so roads beaten or well beaten or fields well bounded. No. This wasn't the wild landscape that we're presenting. It was actually managing to exploit the agricultural resource. And that's part of it. You don't get £40,000 out of Tyrone's lands just by raising cows. And it was mentioned later in the war that it was actually just with crops that, you know, the agricultural yield. That's how he was paying his troops. Remember, these aren't raised levies, these aren't forced men. The people fighting for Tyrone were paid. And if they didn't pay them, they didn't fight. And there's a huge difference in what people see and what it was actually like. Even Dungannon itself, they see this this illustration from 1602 with this old broken castle. But we know that at the start of the war and before that, one, there was troops being drilled there. There was Scottish merchants were staying there. We know that gunpowder was being manufactured there. And this isn't done by people in huts. There's a whole process of how you manufacture gunpowder that involves corning and grilling or sieving and things like that.
So there's a complexity and an industry and energy and organization. You know, it's complex stuff of top level.
It's far more than people would ever give credit for, because what's presented after the war is this broken estate. And people think, oh God, what a ruin that is. No, there's destitute landscapes. No, yeah, this is after 10 years of war. That's what it's like. And O'Neill destroys his castle twice. So that the English, one of the reasons he does it, the Lord Deputy gets a couple of miles. He managed to get there within a couple of miles in 1597. So, or 1596, sorry. So what Tyrone does is he levels his castle and tells his other lords to level their castles. And people just say, what is he doing that for? Because they don't want to take them. And what I sort of can read into it by seeing what he does later is almost a way of removing defensive thinking from him and his adherents. Because what the English are really, really good at is concentrating forces. And so if you give them a target to concentrate against and you have something that you don't want attacked, that's playing to the English strengths. But if you take that away, if you take away your castle, if you take away any sort of anchor to your tactical and offensive thinking, then that's playing to your strengths, and that's what he does.
So it's the ability to move around and dissipate as such, because even in some of the book, there's talk of, you know, Kerry ends up so devastated, many of the people in the rural landscape up and leave and go to Limerick. And that idea of mobility is obviously a very different conception to one we're aware of now. People have less, and maybe their dwelling spaces are more easily and readily buildable faster. You know, like if it's all gone to you know what in front of you, you up and you leave and you go to a place where you can carry, you know, it just seems... I think there was a couple of examples of places where the people up and left and go to another. Oh, it was a somewhere left from, I don't know, it's from Tipperary and they came back a year later, I think 1600 or something like that. Oh, they went up into Ulster, people from Offaly or something like that, because the place had been so devastated. But that concept to us now, to think of, what do you mean they got up and went to another part of the country for a period of time until things had improved. People were obviously able to be much more mobile when there aren't the towns as such and so on.
Yeah, they weren't serfs. They weren't it wasn't Irish society wasn't feudal. They weren't tied to their lord. So yeah, of course, if things were bad, they get up and move. And sometimes it was done deliberately as well. Certainly the scorched earth tactics that were used by Mountjoy wasn't to kill the population as sometimes it's presented. It was actually in some cases to clear the landscape, to take out people that could support Tyrone. Remember, these are the people these are the vast bulk of the people that you never, ever see in the state papers, you never see in the records, but yet they represent the vast majority of the population. That's like the children or the agricultural laborers. And they're almost invisible unless they're down, because they're the people that produce the wealth. Ultimately, Tyrone exploits it, but they're the ones that are growing.
Well, and that's how it all ultimately comes a cropper, because ultimately it all gets brought to a point that there's no ability to carry on the fight as such. The place has been wasted. And again, I think the thing for me that, and it's not romantic, but it's just that sense of like, that is how Ulster gets taken. That is how Ulster has ended up what Ulster is now, a mixed community of planted people who are able to come in to a wasted place as a result of this. It's like, there's so many sliding door moments within this story itself. And then that is one in and of itself as well. The condition that Ulster is left in and left without its chieftains who up and sail away from Rathmullen with the intention, presumably, of encouraging the Spanish to come back, but leaving the place without its leaders, famine, wasted, depopulated, just ripe to be changed and changed it is. But I've jumped too far ahead there now. You mentioned about the Spanish and the Armada and those interactions, but potentially as well for O'Neill. Again, I take it from your book that on instruction, he hanged the Spanish soldiers that he found, but saved the officers. I mean, if that's the case, it's strange to think how that kind of went down well. Maybe it was understood by the Spanish that this was what they had to do, but, you know, that links were made even after the... because. Yeah, I've heard other stories like that where the Spanish soldiers were hunted down, those that survived or swam in off the rocks or whatever it is they did, the ships that limped into bays. And some obviously would have been protected and saved and the like. But it might have given O'Neill also the sense of like, ooh, hang on, because it's shortly after, isn't it? I mean, it's 1588, and you mentioned a couple of subsequent armadas as well. But it's, you know, and this is 1593. But as in the book, you talk about 9 years, is it 10 years, is it 14 years, you know. And McMahon as an example of like, well, this is what could happen to my territory if I don't take proactive action. Maybe this is a way that I can kind of, so I make these links. I use my power and prestige in the, you know, because it's the general wider Ulster area. He's the top dog. I mean, why is it, by the way, that he's the top dog?
He's preeminent. One, because military power. Let's just face it. If you've got more troops, you're in charge. Turlough.
And does he have more troops because he has more money and more land and more ability to generate the revenue to pay for that?
He gets more money, he gets more land, he increases the land's ability to produce. He's also quite the cuter, to use a Northern expression, because he gets because he is seen as the Crown's man. He gets English captains, this is the famous Butter Captains, to come in and train troops, which he's meant to be allowed to keep 600 troops. That's fine. What he does is he cycles those troops through. So
That's right. I remember this. Yes.
So he ends up with a massive.
You're only allowed to train 600 troops, but you didn't say they had to be the same 600 all
exactly.
the time.
And he actually has shooting competitions and things like that. No, like for fairs and things like that. He has like people where they come up and they shoot, and whoever shoots best wins. And the prize is actually a caliber. It's like a light musket. So he was encouraging very much this, and he wasn't. There was no obligation either. These people who were trained to become his bonnets, his paid troops, there was no compulsion. The people he did compel were lesser lords and Uruks, no people who had obligation under Irish law. But the people who made up the troops, the bulks, they were paid for. They were trained by him.
And so meanwhile, he's reaching out and encouraging conspiracy with others and saying, look, this is our chance to what? I mean, what might have his end goal have been? What did he think he could achieve? Or is that knowable?
Ultimately, what he wanted was his final goal was suzerainty, to be top dog in Ulster. That's what he wanted. He didn't want to be king. Some people would actually say, oh, he wanted to be king of Ireland. He didn't, because he didn't actually see himself, like he would have saw himself as an equal of, say, the Earl of Ormond or something like that. Because so on a social level, they were seen as the same. He didn't see himself as king. He saw himself as basically the top dog, as you call it, the top dog in Ulster. But he could see the encroachments happening on his land. So what he said is, well, if I'm ever going to be free of the English, we've all got to be free of the English. Mm. But he didn't see it as some sort of nationalist crusade, to turn it into this great republic. Mm. What he wanted to do was swap sovereigns. Mm. So he'd said to Philip II of Spain about, would you like to be king or would you like your brother to be king? And so the option was to actually just change sovereigns to make the sovereign of Ireland a Spanish one, I suppose, a Spanish Catholic one, as opposed to an English Protestant one. And people say, well, then you'd still be under Spanish control. It's like, I don't think Turin really minded that. Because to be honest, Spain's a long way away when you're in charge in Ulster. And he's not going to have to worry about new English Protestants coming in trying to chop up his land. Because Spain would need the lords that are already there to run this adjunct of the Spanish Empire. But yeah, the fact is that he knew for that to happen, all of Ireland had to be free. Otherwise, there's always going to be the threat that the English will come back. So for him to get what he wanted, everyone had to.
So he's training up significant troops. He's reaching out and fomenting a conspiracy. When and how does that break out? I know it's not that clear because, he flips from at one point doing the work of the crown, relatively speaking, to not doing the work of the crown relatively quickly, Was there a change moment, or was there a cuteness in the previous operations, knowing full well that at some point he was going to flex muscles in a different way?
Well, you see it happening. He says it even in his own writing, he calls it the 14 Years War, because as far as he's concerned, it starts with the Spanish Armada, and he gets the...
That's where he dates it to.
He dates it to then, because that's when he also gets the 8 Spanish captains that end up in Dungannon, one of which, Pedro Blanco, stays with him.
And so, sorry, but did he hang the Spanish soldiers?
There's confusion over that. He writes later to Enda Tyrconnell saying about how this shouldn't have happened, but it was the Hovendons that did it, and the Hovendons were his foster brothers.
Yeah.
And so it's easy to blame them.
Yeah.
So yes, there was Spanish soldiers were hanged, but there's a lot where he'd been transported out through the McDonald's.
Yeah, okay. It's not the key thing. It's just interesting.
Yeah. But they were killed, but he actually has Spanish officers in Dungannon.
Okay.
And one of which is Pedro Blanco, who actually stays with him all the way through. And it's actually with him in Rome when he dies in 1616. Mm. And from that, you start to see how he builds his power base. He's got his political connections, but what he needs to do is establish predominance in Ulster. And he means everyone. Because there's a huge amount of Irish clan lords that are allied to the English. Clandeboy O'Neill's, and he needs to get that crushed.
The Clandeboy O'Neills are the Glens of Antrim side of things.
Oh yeah, they're over around Belfast and over around North Down, things like that. And so what he needs to do is secure all that before he even thinks about anything about moving south. But he has to do that without getting an English response. Like, say if he's hitting the Clandeboy O'Neills here, the Bagnall, he can't do that with the threat of English troops coming up. Mm. So what he does is that he uses Maguire, Hugh Maguire, who's his son-in-law in Fermanagh, to kick off the war there. And uses an excuse of that there's some poor behaviour by an English captain called Willis in Fermanagh. And this is sort of like the spark that sets off Hugh Maguire in Fermanagh. And he puts Willis out of Fermanagh and then raids in the Northern Connaught. And basically starts a shooting war in Fermanagh and in the West. And there's nothing the English like better than a good solid shooting war, because nothing says progress like shooting people. And so that takes their eye way over there. So while their eyes over there at this shooting war, Tyrone is going for around all the different Irish clan lords, and they're going,
you've got a choice here.
Now, lads, we're going to do this. Now you're with me. And then the ones that have their heads screwed on go, aye, no bother, because and so then he bonnets troops on their land. He sends troops to live with them.
Yes.
One, because he says, look at me.
Yes, I can.
I can support you, and look, these troops will be here to aid you. But they're his captains charging them. So while his men are there, what he says goes. Then there's some other people who say, you know, Hugh, it's a great offer, but it's got to be a no. And Hugh's like, all right, fair enough. And
actually, it wasn't a choice. Actually, it wasn't a choice. When you say the English come up, like, you're obviously referring to the Pale and Dublin. I mean, you know, where is the English influence? Is it dotted in places then? Like you mentioned Bagnall and Newry. Dundalk, I know, is the outpost of the Pale. Carlingford, I know, was a walled town, presumably a fortified English town. What other spots are there? You know, I mean, presumably Cork and Limerick and those sorts of places. But is that the case, that the Pale is English power and then there's spots around and obviously clans that have, you know, offered their loyalty and stuff?
Well, you've got the Pale, and then you've got all the big cities, big towns, you'd say. But yeah, you have areas of influence. People, you know, like in the Ulster borderlands, you've got people like Sir Henry Duke has lands in and around there, and you have Carlingford, and you've got Carrickfergus as well.
Carrickfergus, yes.
And so you have English lords and English officers dotted around the place, so that whenever actually it comes to move against, Maguire, Bagnall, as Marshal of Ireland, he's like the Marshal of the English Army, he gets the lead. But and then you have Bingham, Sir Richard Bingham, he's another character, one of in the pantheon of terrible people in late 16th century Ireland. He's stands right up there. He's, treatment of the Irish in Connacht is really quite brutal. And so he's president of, chief commissioner of Connacht. So there is English influence and English forts all around the place. And so when they move, they gather troops from either the garrison, you know, which is like about 1,000 troops based in Ireland. And the Rising Out, which is like it's like a militia of the Old English and their adherents. And that's where these troops are gathered from. So whenever the shooting war starts in Fermanagh, you have Bagnall and Bingham move with a Rising Out against them. The garrison troops as well. So there is military power there, but they can only concentrate in one place. And so they're forced to send it all after Maguire. Not least all the adherents. See all the clan lords, the clan lords for the English in Ulster. They've got no support. There's letters coming out of O'Neill at Clandeboy. O'Neill's going, here, where's that support? He's actually besieged in Cumber in 1593, 1594. And there's letters going to Dublin going, a bit of support here would be great, thanks. It's not forthcoming because they're all over in the West. And he has no option but to submit to Tyrone.
So causing distractions in the West, shoring up support in the East, or enforcing support. And does he do that a couple of times before
he does that throughout 1593, 1594?
He does that ways in different places.
it's all very soft. It's all very here, lads. It's always soft hand first, and it works because even in Fermanagh, where the war kicks off, there's other Maguires. There are no again dynastic losers. No, they end up subject to Hugh Maguire. There's Cormac Maguire, who is totally pro-English. He's, whenever there's campaigns into Fermanagh in 1583 and 1584, he's totally on the English side. But eventually, as O'Neill secures his dominance, he has no choice. But he ends up, he has to submit to Tyrone, because it's basically Tyrone's way or the highway, and the highway is terminal for most people if they don't side with him. But what we see happening there, when Tyrone's actually pretending to be loyal, he also sees some glimpses into how he can be utterly callous and one of the examples you have of it is whenever they finally gather an army to move against Maguire, it's under Bagnall, and they march up along the Erne, and Tyrone joins Bagnall. It's all because he's told to, but he doesn't turn up with as many troops as he said he's going to turn up with. And there's all, he sort of stymies the, Bagnall has this great plan for, he meets Maguire at a ford just south of Enniskillen, but it's heavily fortified and Bagnall can't force it, it won't force it, because Maguire has these trenches all lined with shot, people armed with calibers, no guns, and he can't force it. And so he comes up with these mad plans about how he'd march around and Tyrone would fix Maguire in place. Tyrone doesn't cooperate and says, oh, you can't do this and you can't do that. And forces, ultimately by not cooperating, forces Bagnall to march north. And then he meets an Irish force at Balik. Now, this force isn't the one that Maguire had. It's not armed with guns or pike. It's not the modernized force that Maguire has. Which, by the way, the reason why Maguire has any strength is because these are Tyrone's troops that have been sent under his brother, Cormac MacBarron. That's where all this, these are still Tyrone's troops. So literally Tyrone's seeing his own troops on the other side. But he forces Bagnall to march north and he meets another section of Irish troops holding the ford at Balik. And these are all old style. These are Galloglass and Cairn and some shot, but mostly all Galloglass under McSweeney's actually. And to maintain this image of the loyal man, charges as Bagnall's infantry are crossing the ford, they're taking some fire, but they're making their way across the ford, and the Irish start to decamp. No, they're starting to march away. Tyrone charges these troops with his own cavalry and slaughters them. He kills over 300 McSweeneys just to maintain. Literally, his loyalty is shown in the bloody spills. And as far as they're concerned, job done. But they didn't touch Maguire's modern forces. The strength of Maguire is untouched, but Bagnall thinks he's done a great job, and Tyrone looks really, really loyal. And so reportedly were 300 killed. Not a problem. That's...
And the Galloglass are like Norse Scottish fighters brought in by the Irish over centuries. The Galloglass, the young foreign fighters, I think is what it translates as. The Kerns are and they're quite heavily armored and they've big long axes, and the Kerns are usually Irish and they've lighter equipment and defensive and different technologies for fighting, essentially, is the way to define the difference between the two. But McSweeney, the name which continues to exist in Ireland, and Terence McSweeney, a famous one in Cork, of course, they are of the Galloglass. But are they Irish at this point, having been here for generations?
Oh yes, I think they're Irish now because they've been here for so long. Yeah, they're
but still they're there to be sort of used as an example.
Galloglass have no place in Tyrone's new army. When I say the Galloglass, the technology, the system of Galloglass and the heavy infantry with axe and mail, Tyrone has no use for them.
Piece of the past that has no place in the future.
That's actually one of the things that if people are looking for something more cerebral, we'll know they're going, well, what does this tell us about our society? And one of the things, big debates about our society at the time was it, could it change or was it moribund? Was it just decaying? And was it something fixed in like the medieval past? And often this is used as an excuse for, well, this is the transformative effect of the English colonization, is that they brought a dying society, this moribund society, into the future. Which is total nonsense. Because what you actually start to see is this transformation is a reflection of how adaptive the Irish are. Because if you look at other societies, one of the ones that compared to would maybe be Russia or the Ottomans, is that the influx of new technology is resisted. No, this transformative effect is resisted by military elites. No, with they have a vested interest in the current system. No, that's what they've always done, and so that's so you get resistance for people who have an interest in the old system. You don't see that. There is no resistance, or none that's recorded. You don't see people. There's no record of the Galloglass family going, we're not doing that. We're not taking guns. This is the way we've always said. In a matter of 10 years, the old order, the old military system that you would have seen in the Desmond rebellions, you know, with the Cairn and the Galloglass, gone. You see the last ends of them, but just at the start of the war, you see there's these Galloglass, and then you see a few appearing in maybe, say, 1594, 1595. By 96, nothing. If you look at the records for people getting injured, that's how you, one of the key wins. Once they never reported again, it's always shot in the pike and swordsman, as opposed to before you had the Galloglass in the car. But also you see the injuries inflicted on English soldiers when they reported, no English officers. Everyone's getting shot. No one's to that. It's only at the start of the war we see people not getting hit with an axe. By 1585, 1586, everyone's getting shot. Occasionally piked, but it's all shot. There's nothing with the old style.
So you just described a scene where O'Neill allows the suggestion of his loyalty to be maintained at a time when actually he's conspiring and scheming. And I know we're to get to Kinsale, which feels a long way off. So I wonder, like, but I think we've filled in a lot around it that it'll make the subsequent description easier to countenance. But maybe we need to try to speed through a little bit of, or if not speed through, link through. I mean, Bagnall, when does Essex come in? Because ultimately then there's Mountjoy, and Mountjoy changes the tactics and changes the whole nature of it. But you spoke earlier about how O'Neill has this succession of wins. At one point could have marched on Dublin and maybe should have marched on Dublin. And I know he is a very effective defence of the Moiré Pass, which again interests me, being from Dundalk, that gap of the north. I mean, what people might know, is it geographically or geologically? But Northern Ireland is a place apart. There's really only two good entry points into the north from the south of Ireland, and it's the Gap of the North, as it's called, the Moiré Pass, Slea Mairi, which I think is the Way of the Salmon or something, is some of my exploration of what that name might mean. And that's between Dundalk and Newry. And then it's Ballyshannon and over in Donegal. They're the two easiest ways in because of all of the, like, there was a glacier basically that the Drumlins of Monaghan, the Lakes of Cavan. It's just not territory that's easy to get in and out of. And the two easiest passes are Ballyshannon and Dundalk, and why they're fought over, and why Dundalk is the head of the pale. And I know he wins a battle in the Moiré Pass, but he wins a series of battles, the Yellow Ford and the like. To try to get us to the point where, because then the Spanish come to, I mean, I'm speeding through it, forgive me. The Spanish come to the wrong part of Ireland. Aguila, there's three of them. There's Aguila and there's a few others. He seems to be slightly reluctant. He might have fallen foul of the King of Spain. And then this is him. He kind of got put into this role and he maybe didn't want to do it. And they come to the wrong part of Ireland. Why they come to the south or not the west or the north. I have sped way through it there. Where does Bagnall... And where does Essex come in? Because Essex doesn't have success against O'Neill and ultimately ends up replaced, and Mountjoy makes the difference. So what's that Bagnall-Essex-Mountjoy transition?
Well, you have the huge amount, we're flying through it, actually, with the huge section of the war, 1595. O'Neill finally jumps in, they're both feet, start of 1595.
Yes, he's out. I'm in rebellion.
Yeah. Don't even like the word rebellion.
No,
rebellion.
Don't you? Oh, so what is the better word to describe it then? Revolt?
See, rebellion is a term we're sort of stuck with. Maybe they invent a better word, because rebellion can be seen as a war against the proper authority.
Whereas he's asserting that he is the proper authority.
Yeah, he's asserting, well, actually, that the English don't have authority here, so it can't be a rebellion against something that doesn't have validity.
And Elizabeth is the queen at this point.
Elizabeth is, yes, still very much the queen. And she sends a succession of...
And she's disgusted because he's a loyal subject.
She won't even let the word war be used. Because war is a term that is used, as she described it to her own officers, as it is a war is conflict between sovereigns, between equals. No, even if one side's bigger than the other.
So there's a snobbery even in the use of the word.
She wouldn't even allow them to use the word war. It had to be rebellion.
Okay.
And then she wouldn't even allow it to say, when someone mentioned about peace with O'Neill, she lost the battle again. Because peace is made between sovereigns. Submission is made by recalcitrant rebels, recalcitrant subjects. Mm. So there was only rebellion and submission. You weren't to be talking about peace and war. But she sends a succession of people through 1596-97. O'Neill expands this right into the south. We're talking like the start of war, 1593 up to 95. You're talking about it's a war for Ulster. Right after that, it's a war for Ireland. So he pushes south. And when you say pushing south, stop looking at the battles. Often people go, well, that's where the fighting is going to... No, but often the fighting is not where he's making political gains. And he's creating alliances.
In the same way we already explained.
Exactly.
Diversionary tactics in order, because he's off doing business that's securing a whole wide area.
Yeah, all of a sudden they're fighting in some valley in Armagh. And O'Neill's people are making alliances in Offaly and Kilkenny, and all of a sudden there's like fighting in Wexford, and like, what's going on there? So off, so you can't, people have often been distracted by where the fighting is, but no, there's gains over all throughout Ireland. This gets to the point where they send the largest force put together yet. That's under 4,000, 4,500 sent up north under Bagnall to try and relieve Blackwater Fort in Armagh. This all goes wrong for Bagnall, all goes right for Tyrone, because he's prepared to grind and knows what he's doing. Hammers the force to the Battle of the Yellow Ford. He kills upwards of half of them, including Bagnall.
They must have been shocked.
Oh,
and this is Bagnall. This is Bagnall now, who's the older brother of Hugh's wife, but she might be out of the picture at this point.
She's dead. She doesn't last long. She's died by 1594.
Wow.
But
Bagnall would have been gung-ho to go in and make amends or to seek revenge, and he ends up dead. But it must have shocked the authorities that this largest force ever gathered in Ireland can be beaten so easily.
And beaten easily. And they had everything. They had all their cavalry. They had their cannon. They had everything in the place. That should have said they should have marched to the Blackwater, and Tyrone would have been swept aside, because that's what they expected. But their arrogance, there's a certain level of military arrogance that went with it that they paid the price for it.
So let me ask you something, Jim, because this actually is also what interests me about this period, because, you know, when you learn of Irish history and you learn of what happened, you kind of wondered, how was there never a coalescing together to resist? This is it. And arguably from 1168, had there been a greater coalescence of Irish forces to resist English incursion or this is it, really?
I don't think there was. I think that's again, people say that they only had a genius for military improvements, the revolution in the Irish military. He creates a confederation unprecedented, and for up until Mountjoy, the English couldn't really get their head around the fact that he'd created this coalition, and he created a coalition that, again, he could have things happen, a level of military sophistication that was across the island. He could have things done in Connacht that influenced the military situation in Armagh. He could have things done in the Midlands.
He was like a puppet master.
He had coordination and a level of operational sophistication that the English just couldn't get their head around until Mountjoy realized, hold on a sec here, you have small letters coming out from officers going, this is nothing we've seen before. But the upper echelons in England just... It takes them to 1600 to realize that they're up against.
So Essex comes in after Bagnall is killed.
Oh, yeah. After that, the Queen decides, right, we're going to send my best guy. Well, he actually wasn't her best guy, but he talked a good talk.
Yeah.
And we're going to raise the troop levels to unprecedented numbers, 18,000. She didn't come with an army of 18,000. She sent reinforcements to make it 18,000. Unfortunately for Tyrone, and unfortunately for the English, he is no match in any level for the what Tyrone is doing. He's a military dilettante. He talks a better talk and organizes a better fight than actually fights. And he just gets the fritters away this massive amount of money and troops. And he's like, he goes on this busy march around Munster and makes a great deal of taking Carrick Castle. He goes, oh, I could do nothing until I took Carrick Castle. And I was like, well, no one had even heard about Carrick Castle beforehand until he said he wanted to take it.
And is Carew down there at that time as well?
No, Carew doesn't come up till 1600.
Okay.
And then fritters away is the forces he has and the money he has. Blames everyone else. Says, oh, this didn't happen, that didn't happen. Oh, while he's busy messing around in Munster, you have disasters happening. The English army's routed in the Curly Pass under Sir Conyers Clifford. They take a hammering, and Clifford, who's the commissioner in Munster, he's killed. You have Henry Harrington is overthrown in Wicklow. Their forces take an absolute hammering. So it's not going well.
And is he kind of avoiding the issue? Is it almost kind of like being able to send back, oh, it's all going so well, but actually he's nowhere near where he needs to be?
Absolutely dropping the ball completely. He writes.
But is it deliberate, do you think? Is it almost deliberate to avoid having to face up to it?
I think I'm not very kind to Essex in the book. And I think he had this fear of failure. He certainly is. When things didn't go his way in England, he sort of threw strops and closed. It's basically run to your bedroom and not talking to anyone. Mm. And he does this in England after certain mishaps. And he does it here, that he blames everyone is doing it wrong. And the reason why it's a failure was everyone else's fault apart from his, even though he's the one, the one in charge. Mm. And says troops are cowardly, even though he sends them all in penny packets into loads of these tiny garrisons and totally dilutes any sort of military strength. And then he finally gets to the point where he's undermined his military strength so much that then he can say, well, look at this, I can't do this now. And literally he's undermined his ability to do it, and then he creates an impossible task, and then he says, well, I can't do this impossible, even though he's responsible in the first place. Then he meets with Tyrone and the northern borders, and he just doesn't have the numbers. He even comes off with a stupid idea of like this grandstanding, let us meet one on one, you know, me and you, Tyrone, and we'll settle this once and for all. Turns like, yeah, yo-ho. And then he have this famous, they have this meeting in by the river.
Sorry, what ages are they, Jim, just to give me an idea of
Essex? I can't remember what age.
Well, no, but even O'Neill, like, what age is, what period of his life is it?
O'Neill was born in 1550, I think.
He's in his late 40s.
Hitting the back end of his 40s. And so Essex cuts a deal, another ceasefire. Which have always, ceasefires, the thing is he's playing straight into Tyrone's hands because he's always used ceasefires to create breathing space. Some officers go, this always works as his advantage. It allows him to reposition troops, resupply troops, and basically set everything up for recommencing hostilities. Essex falls for it because he wants to. He wants to get out. And then in no time at all, he goes to England. And busy deserts his command on the pretense that he's going over to say what happened to the Queen. She's not happy. He ends up arrested. And then ultimately, when he gets out, he starts this really sad twitch, for want of a better word, and he's arrested and executed the next year. It's a sorry end. This is all comes a cropper in Ireland. Finally.
Do they campaign across winters or you know?
Not normally.
Yeah.
That's where Mountjoy comes in, though.
Yeah.
Mountjoy. So
just before Mountjoy, then, is it the Yellow Ford where O'Neill could have marched on Dublin? Like, is there a point where he maybe had a chess piece move to make that he didn't make that could have made all the difference? Or was there an end game ever in sight for him, or did he know what his end game was? Like, or was he just going to hope that he could keep countering whatever came his way? Was that it?
Well, he's waiting on the Spanish. I think he's waiting because they've been promising.
Yeah.
And they said they were going to send the big armada, and they did in 1596. And then Philip changed his mind at the last minute and sent it to Spain, or sent it to France. And that was 12,000 troops. Could you imagine what 12,000 Spanish troops would have done here?
It's like, that's what I mean, sliding doors. It's like the whole, we could be communicating in a different language right now.
I know people always push me. When I'm chatting on Twitter, they're like, go on, what would have happened? I was like, nope, I'm not playing that game.
Well, historians tend not to like to do that. They like to just deal with what happened as opposed to what could have happened. But we could have been chatting in Gaelic and able to chat in Spanish as well, and English. We might have had a load of language.
We sitting having tapas for Christmas.
Okay. But Mountjoy then, Charles Blount.
Charles Blount. More of a cerebral soldier. Definitely one.
Is he, by the way, the Mountjoy Square and Mountjoy?
I don't know. I'm not sure. People always ask me that. I'm not sure. Mm. Like Mountjoy Prison and all that could have been named after someone later. I'm not sure. But he is experienced. Like, he has campaigned in France. And the Queen actually tries to go to France again, and the Queen gives off to him and says, sends him back to Windsor Castle for his studies. There's apparently a great library there, and he's meant to be studying all the works of military history and Roman history and things like that. And so finally, Essex actually slags him off one time because he's saying he's just a book soldier, which is a bit cheap coming from him. Mountjoy finally gets sent, and this is actually, he gets sent just probably the English are really at their low point. Like they say, it's easy to say, well, O'Neill could have marched on Dublin after the Yellow Ford. But the fact is, the whole reason he did the Yellow Ford was because he knew there was a big landing force had been put together to land in Derry, and he couldn't have that. So because Tyrone never killed troops just for the sake of killing troops. He wasn't a body count sort of guy. What he wanted was to affect the overall strategic situation, and he couldn't have 2,000 troops landing in Derry. So he slaughters the army because he knows that those are going to get sent to defend Dublin. And so he couldn't march in Dublin because he still had the threat of that land. He couldn't march with the possibility of 2,000 troops still landing in the rear. So after the Essex debacle, Tyrone marches to Cork, totally uncontested. By February, and by January 1600, Tyrone marches, is looking at Conceal. No one touched him. He marches from the north, straight through the Midlands, past Cork, stays for a while there, sees Cork, sees Conceal, possibly where the whole Conceal idea comes from, is when he, because so dominant he is, then he finds out that Mountjoy has landed as Lord Deputy in Dublin in February, I think it is. And then he marches back again. And actually sort of tips his hand a wee bit, I reckon, because Mountjoy sees that any threat on Ulster will force Tyrone march. And he marches actually really, I think he does it in 10 days. It's just an amazing feat of marching that he marches from like Cork to Ulster in less than 2 weeks.
And I presume he's kind of asserting his strength and surveying positions and places.
And there's nothing the allies, the people he's talked into joining him all through the Midlands and all and in the Munster, as a big show of strength. And no English troops come near. No, there's no attempt to stop him. And there's nothing there to stop him. And so this is probably the high point. Because also, what I didn't mention is that after Yellow Ford, that's when Munster goes up in flames. That whole plantation totally collapses. It turns into, Tyrone sends a small force of maybe 800 and they are just across the border into Munster, and the whole place just falls apart. It's not.
There's a bit of viciousness there, isn't there? Like there, it's like more, as if there's a lingering feeling from the Desmond Rebellion that was suppressed, and there's a civilians, and there's a bit of
there's a bit of the old massacre and a bit of the old ultraviolence that you don't really see.
That's almost a little reflection of what occurs in 1641, which is another point in Irish history.
It's the kind of thing you didn't see in this war.
It's potentially sectarian, even.
Oh yeah, very much so. I think, and I think even the Irish lords in Munster are surprised, and they even write back saying, "We have to get a hold of this before." The mob is basically in charge here, and so they take over and they get a handle on it. By the time Tyrone is marching down there, the English position is pretty much just the towns, some forts, and bits of the Peel. There's even people in the Peel paying Tyrone black rent tax. He's taxing.
So they've never been at a weaker point in their entire time on the island of Ireland.
There's nothing to stop them. Literally, he marches the length. Back all the way down to Cork and back up again without anyone firing a shot at them. They're writing like he's doing this in broad daylight. There's like see all this guerrilla warfare sort of hit and run stunts.
And yet 12 to 18 months later,
it's all different. And that's
so Mountjoy's the guy. He's just got a different way about him. He's got different tactics. It's almost like he sort of changes the rules, does he? He goes, "Oh, we never fight at night, we'll fight at night. We never fight in winter, we'll fight in winter." Like all of the things that you're not supposed to do, we'll do in order. Like he's just sort of ruthless, is he?
What I would say, he's the first one that turns up that doesn't think of the Irish as backwards. These are the people that are putting England, Gloriana's England, have almost lost Ireland, and they've not done this by luck. He's the one that recognises what Tyrone's at. He sees the strengths of the Irish, and he sees the strengths of Tyrone, and so he decides to work to his strengths. One, he decides, well, the troops we're using aren't working for us. So contrary to what you might read in older books where they say about the Irish copying the English, he copies Tyrone's reforms. He gets rid of the heavier muskets, which are limited mobility. He limits the amount of pikes, which are limited mobility. He gets rid of the armor, which is limited mobility, and start to try and make his troops as mobility is key. And starts to make his troops look more like the Irish, not the other way around, and operate more like the Irish.
And sorry, something I wanted to mention. The other fact of the matter is they are Irish troops.
Absolutely.
The English troops, as we call them, a lot of the time are composed, maybe not as much of Irish troops, but anyway, it's not as clear cut as anything is. It's Irish against Irish in many occasions.
Oh yeah, like the rank and file troops, sometimes this contains 30-40%, sometimes whole companies are entirely made of Irish, even though they're counted as English troops. But the way they were fighting was by English methods. These dense formations, which just wasn't working. They were, their tactical and operational mobility was just ridiculous. The Irish.
So he studied his opponent and said, "All right, I'm going to match you."
Yeah, he says, "I'm going to change that." He changes the way they're trained. He changes the way they're fed, and he institutes reforms that allows them to get a level of mobility that allows them to move across the landscape somewhere to match the Irish. What he also does is he sees that Tyrone, his key concern is always Ulster. And so what he does is he institutes landings in Derry, a large force, 4,000 troops under Dockery. He lands in May on the Foyle, because that limits how Tyrone can operate, because all of a sudden he's got a massive force in his rear area behind him. Yeah, he can't. So what he actually ends up doing is how he'd actually secured the loyalty of Southern lords. We remember saying about he sends troops. And so then they can say, well, these are my troops and I'm militarily strong. But as long as they've got troops, but they're Tyrone's troops, they have to do what he said. He has to withdraw some of those troops, pull them away from his allies. They have to leave them to stand there on 2 feet to secure the rear areas, to strengthen Ulster. As a term used, it basically bridles his entire operations outside Ulster. That gives Mountjoy the opportunity to cut through the Irish Midlands. One, forcing Irish lords to submit. And two, it cuts off lines of supply. Because one of Tyrone's mistakes is he actually concentrates logistical force in the north, all where the supplies of gunpowder and weapons are coming through him. So that's a direct... And Mountjoy sees that. So when he cuts those lines through the Midlands, he takes those Irish lords out of the equation and cuts off the gunpowder supplies to the south. No, in Munster and things like that. And that's where you start to see it all start to come apart outside Ulster, is because once they've transformed their troops, the Tyrone's, but Tyrone's troops are predicated on gun, no, shooting weapons. And when there's no gunpowder, they're stuck to using things like their pike, and they're forced to use their pike in ways that they weren't designed. Forced to use them in attacks, which they weren't really, the Irish pike were more like a defensive unit.
Against the cavalry charge.
Yeah, to keep the cavalry at bay, and that's pretty much it. But then they're forced to act like they weren't trained, and then all of a sudden you start to see loss after loss after loss. And you also see, how I actually discovered this, is you start to look at the wounds being reported. And before that, when they have good supplies of gunpowder, all the English officers are getting shot. But after that, any wounds that are being reported, they're all being piked or hit with swords. So that once you take gunpowder out of the equation, it totally undermines the combat strength, and you start to see loss after loss after loss.
But in the midst of this, the Spanish finally come.
Finally. They took their time.
At this point in this Cork History Matters podcast chat with author Jim O'Neill on the 9 Years' War, 1593 to 1603, let's take a little break and we'll recommence with part two, which will take us directly into the heart of the action at the Battle of Kinsale, 1601.
For more Red FM podcasts, go to redfm.ie/podcasts.